Hi, Rocketeers. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for our goddess, Guy Branum, who's touring his brand new book this week. So he's not here to join us, but we're wishing him well wherever he is. And welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wobbler.
Hello there, Karen.
Hey, Magwops. How's it been going for you this week? How have you been surviving this particular heat wave?
I'm surviving, barely. I mean, my main cause of concern right now is some throbbing blood pressure feelings from this matcha latte I had.
That's such an LA problem.
I know. I'm a tender soul. I don't have a lot of caffeine, and I just did it all wrong.
Well, hopefully our finest vintage of red wine here at Max Fun Studios can help you downshift a little bit. And we have a very special guest this week. In fact, it is our pod godmother, the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, which many of you know may have inspired Pop Rocket a little bit. Mm-hmm. And she's the pop culture critic, lapsed lawyer, and now first-time novelist, the great Linda Holmes. Welcome.
Aww, thank you so much. It's great to be here. I'm excited and planning to replace Guy. So this is step one.
A little all about even going on here.
Yes. Step one in my long plan to replace Guy.
Nice.
You've heard it, Guy. The long grift is on.
Yeah, it's true.
I feel like if you're going to have the goddess mantle and the godmother mantle, you need like a what's it called? You know, a crown and a scepter
and
of some sort.
And a wand or a scepter. Yeah. Well, so beyond trying to take over Guy Branum's goddess role here.
Right.
What brings you to the West Coast this time around?
I'm in California with the Television Critics Association at their summer press tour, where the networks and streaming services and other providers. We used to just be able to say the networks, the broadcast and cable networks, but now you sort of feel like it's going to be like, and also, what's coming to your vending machine? But
and whatever the burrito box is playing.
Exactly. And they roll out their new shows that are coming up. They try to get critics interested in them. They give you press conferences where you can ask questions of the people who make the shows and things like that. So I'm out here doing that. And then just seeing everybody I can while I'm here.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, welcome to L.A. We're sorry it's so hot, but hopefully you have some nice digs.
This is not a heat wave to me. in D.C., it would be A, hotter than this, and B, swampily humid. So I am in heaven because it's not humid.
In a dry heat heaven. So coming up on this week's show, we're actually going to be revisiting that wonderfully awkward time of our lives of Clearasil and body self-consciousness, eighth grade. And it's the new film out by former YouTube star, comedian, and now filmmaker Bo Burnham. I almost called him Branham. Bo Burnham. They're not related. And so we're going to be chatting about eighth grade, the film, as well as eighth grade popular culture, our particular eighth grade experiences around popular culture. And of course, we'll have our latest jams. But first, let's find out what we're all about this week. Magwops, I think you have a continuation story here from a carryover from the previous episode.
Yeah, last week we didn't get to do all abouts because we talked about The Rock and denied him his seal of approval. But I really want to talk about the one that I had in mind because it's such a fantastic article. It's Taffy Brodesser-Ackner's profile of Gwyneth Paltrow and her company Goop. And it's in the New York Times Magazine. It came out July 25th. And it is just a masterclass in profile writing. To me, I mean, Taffy's a friend of mine, and so I'm incredibly biased, but I would say this if I never knew her at all. But her profiles are like the closest thing we have to like event journalism in like the profile writing world.
That's true. Very true.
Yeah. I mean, she just, you know, go look up anybody she's written about from like Don Lemon to... Yeah, of course, I'm like blanking on anyone else besides Don Lemon because I love that piece so much. It is in GQ and it starts with this ridiculous instance of him mispronouncing sorbet. Anyway, go look it up. It's amazing. But she writes all about Goop and how it has risen from this business in 2008 that just kind of seemed like Gwyneth's little fancy Martha Stewart-like project to something ginormous and aspirational and worth $250 million.
Wow. I had no idea it had gotten that valuable?
It's gotten so big. I mean, there's now a Goop wellness conference. You know, it sells tons of merchandise. What the story covers is some changes that it's going through. It did partner for a little bit with Vogue magazine, which was a partnership that ultimately didn't work out because Vogue, like most glossy magazines, has a really rigorous fact-checking department. And they really couldn't fact-check a lot of these claims about, you know, jade eggs cleaning out your vagina and things like that. So Vogue basically said, let's go our separate ways, and Goop has gone on to do other things. But the article is fascinating for just getting so close to the Gwyneth shine. At one point, Taffy goes over to her house for dinner. There's like Chris Martin in the other room, like playing guitar and singing like Blackbird with his children. And she's steaming some clams and baking bread in her oven. And it all just seems so effortless. And they smoke a cigarette together because Gwyneth, you know, famously smokes like a few cigarettes a year. And that's like her bad habit. And she just does such a brilliant job of showing this woman who at once is like perfect, but then and eerily so, but then also like might possibly be heading up one of the biggest like snake oil businesses we have in our world. It's a very interesting read, too, because it examines wellness as a trend. I mean, wellness is an absolute ginormous industry at this point. As a person with some thyroid issues and members of my family having autoimmune disease, and I think a lot of women, especially in LA, are very suspicious of like Western medicine because they've been left out in the cold and they haven't gotten good treatment and they've had their problems just sort of shrugged away by male doctors. Goop is sort of like catching all of those women, the faithless, and saying, we have something for you. And so on one side, I can like... there's parts of the sort of Goop mission that like I believe in, that like there's certain things that are in the wellness sector that can't be tested by the pharmaceutical industry because they can't make money off of it. So like, yeah, why not get those things for ourselves? And at the same time, like, do I believe that vaginal steams really do anything? Probably not. So
other than steam your vagina.
Right. Which probably feels good. I've never tried one. I don't know. Readers tell me. So it's great. Go check it out.
If we had more time, I would tell the story of a friend who was once a rival bridesmaid with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Wow.
But in any case, I probably have revealed too much already. So I'm going to scamper out of this topic and get over here to Linda and ask Linda, what are you all about this week?
Well, this week I am all about a new study out of USC Annenberg, the inclusion initiative there, which is connected to some of the same people who have worked on the inclusion riders that Frances McDormand was talking about at the Oscars, that helped bring the work that those women have been doing more to the spotlight. But the recent study went into kind of how many roles are available for women in major films, and then women of color, women with disabilities, by age, just talking about a lot of different elements. And the real takeaway was that there's been very, 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 very little progress over the last, say, 8 to 10 years, which I have to admit I found a little bit surprising. I think I've been encouraged by individual examples more than perhaps I should have been. It still remains the case that the vast majority of the time, women are outnumbered as in speaking roles, and that's, of course, as in all things, you know, ways of being marginalized tend to be layered on top of each other so that it's even worse for women of color, even worse for queer women, especially queer women of color. And, you know, so it's sort of all of those things, I think, stack up. And what it made me think about was that I do hear a lot from people from the entertainment journalist community, particularly the critical community that I'm involved in. There are people who have taken a lot of interest in talking about these kinds of things, both in movies and in television. And then there are just a lot of people who frankly don't. And it has just made me increasingly frustrated that there are people who, for example, to give an example, can get extremely exercised about the fairness or unfairness of James Gunn not being able to direct Guardians of the Galaxy 3 because of what that means for, is that just, what does that mean for other filmmakers? What does that mean for the good of the world? But who don't really care at all about the underrepresentation of voices and the underrepresentation of, you know, characters as well as actors as well as creators. So it has kind of, I mean, to me, it's very discouraging because I spend a lot of time talking about and writing about and thinking about this stuff. So I think it has just, I don't really know what to do other than tell people, like, you as a consumer, you as a creator, you absolutely have to place pressure because advocacy has not yet demonstrated a whole lot of progress, at least in the feature film arena. I think there are some doors that are opening in other places, but, you know, feature films anyway.
Although this study, it's so comprehensive. It's like a 10-year mm-hmm. period mm-hmm. of collecting data from 2007 mm-hmm. to 2017. One of the things that it points out is that even if TV is a slightly more amenable place for female creators, directors, and you know, on-camera as well as off-camera talent, the numbers have remained staggeringly stagnant.
Yes, exactly.
For this period of time. And it was just, you know, I think that that's one of the things that I try to, this particular study is one that I try to point out to my students, especially when they're working completely within the realm of representation and what they think they see on mm-hmm. television, and also all of the stories that tend to lift up some individual figures,
right.
Ava DuVernay's, you know, or even a show like Queen Sugar with all female directors for like its run. But, you know, that is really just the tiny, tiny drop of water in this vast ocean of unfairness.
Right. And the thing is, you can always want, and I do want, and I'm grateful for, those individual examples where somebody who is really hungry for things to look at where they see either themselves represented, you know, in the characters or in the makers or whatever, I'm very grateful for those things. But ultimately, it still means that you're dealing with a very broken system. And one of the things is, you know, I don't want to take anything away from the importance of highlighting the individual bad behavior of individual people who have been called out about their behavior in the last year or so, whether it's sexual harassment or just workplace bullying or other things or racism or whatever. But, you know, it is one thing to go individually after those individual people. It is another to understand how complex those systems are. And the fact that over time, the presence of those individual people is not necessarily what's driving these inequalities as much as the system that they are part of and the way that their operations are reinforced by, you know, absolute power. And I happen to be somebody who believes that the more you are able to diffuse power, the more you keep it from being so much abused. So I found the study really depressing, but in another way, it just made me feel like, well, it's just going to be more of just insisting upon having this conversation.
It is with equal gravitas that I present what I'm all about this week.
Yeah, please. I was a little bit of a downer there.
And I'm warning everyone now, for those of you who are not caught up with the most recent episode of The Affair, that is season 4, episode 7, you may want to skip my all about because I'm going to get into a few spoilers. But wow, what an episode. And many of you know that Maura Tierney would be in my coven, that I, in fact, have been worshiping Maura Tierney for many years.
She's so delightful.
She's
correct.
Amazing, an amazing actress. She's so delightful. Well, finally, I think all of my dreams came true this particular week because we had a very Helen-centric, Helen perspective episode for the first half, and Helen's spiritual quest at a moon circle in Joshua Tree leads to some
Is this my life?
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, you tell me if this is your life, Magwath, because
okay.
It leads to some sapphic dabbling in a yurt with the young Sierra, played by Emily Browning. And this character has, I guess it's like the previous episode or a couple of episodes before, has already slept with with Helen's husband, Vic, who is, spoiler, dying of pancreatic cancer this season. And so that is part of what, you know, sends Helen off, you know, like she's kind of confronting his you know, like his own unwillingness to like grapple with the severity of the situation and also with just the kind of, you know, like the kind of harshness of everyday life. And finally, she succumbs to this young, nubile neighbor's invitation to like, why not check it out? Like, come meet my guru. Let's come to the desert. Fuck it. Let's go. You know, and the thing about that, aside from, of course, the sapphic dabbling, which is very like exciting for me, and, you know, every aspect, every layer of how this plot played out aesthetically as well was just so pitch perfect, I think, from its kind of parodic take of the, like, you know, kind of Angelino spirituality.
Yes.
And the sense that someone could be a guru just because they put some sort of like slightly offensive headdress on and burn some sage in your face. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, what it does is also show how these kind of weird rituals can be a pathway to other kinds of enlightenment or self-knowing. And it's like, you know, Helen really emerges in this particular episode as having accrued her own wisdom in many respects that she gets to finally share with a captive audience that no one's kind of bothered to like accept or listen to in the whole arc of the affair. And plus, you know, I mean, it's, I think it's like a very amber toned, the scene in which they get together. It's very amber toned. We're listening to Patti Smith.
Yes,
there's
a
little weed, a little wine. Anyway, I thought that it was magnificent, and Maura Tierney can convey so much with just the tiniest arch of an eyebrow or, like, you know, squishing of her mouth in a kind of strange puzzlement.
Mm.
So we'll be right back after this to talk eighth grade.
Hi, everybody. I'm your oldest brother, Justin McElroy.
I'm your middlest brother, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your sweet baby brother, Griffin McElroy.
Me and 3,000 of your closest friends just found your next podcast obsession.
Cereal!
Okay, but like the second best podcast.
Cereal!
Oh, just listen to my brother, and me on MaximumFun.org.
There you go.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Before we get into this main segment, I just wanted to warn you all that we're going to be talking about the entirety of the film Eighth Grade, so beware that there are numerous spoilers in our discussion. Thank you. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Margaret Wappler
and Linda Holmes.
So today we're going to go back to Eighth Grade by way of Bo Burnham's new film that he's written and directed, with the title Eighth Grade. Margaret, can you give us a little quick synopsis of what happens in this film?
Well, the movie starts with us seeing Kayla Day, who is an eighth grader, making a YouTube video where she is doling out advice on how to be yourself. And she's talking about how at school everyone thinks that she's really quiet, but she's actually really like talkative and funny and exciting. And she's super awkward on this video. It's very grainy. We start to see that her life is very different from the kind of advice that she is doling out in these videos. Basically, at school, you see her get an award when they give out the superlatives for that year. You see her get the award for most quiet. And her crush, Aiden, gets best eyes. And when he brushes right by her, she says, good job. And he just completely ignores her. And you see that she has this life where in her mind, she wants to be this fabulously popular, you know, go-getting cool girl. And she just can't grab it yet. She's still like, in a lot of ways, a late bloomer, very awkward, lives with her dad, who is affectionate and sweet. But
and he's a single dad.
Single dad, yeah, who doesn't really know how to connect with her. Like, does his sort of best effort, but really just doesn't know what to say a lot of times. And eventually you see her befriend a high school girl when she goes to high school to sort of shadow an older student to learn the ropes for when she's going to start high school. And that kind of gives her some entree into a social scene that she really wants. But it also has some hurtful moments for her. And it's a really touching and tender movie that really does bring you back to your own eighth grade days.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to ask you both, actually, is that what was your kind of own bodily or emotional response when you sat in that theater and watched it? Because I know that people have had very powerful reactions to the way it's shot, to also the perspectives that we get to see in the film. Like, did it make you feel uncomfortable? Did you get sent back to, like, that previous time? Did it provoke anxiety?
I don't think that it particularly... I didn't have as powerful of a cringe response as a lot of people did. I mostly just feel like... See, I think my reaction was, I don't feel like she's that awkward. I don't feel like she's that... you know, she is quiet, and she certainly is... the way that she goes about her life... She's quiet, and therefore she doesn't really have a lot of friends because she doesn't talk to people, and people have kind of learned to, they mostly just leave her alone. And one of the things that I respect about the way that Bo Burnham is drawing the pain of eighth grade and adolescence and wanting to fit in here is that it, for the most part, there's very little of her being bullied or mistreated. She's mostly just unseen. She's mostly just not, she doesn't exist to most of the people who she wants to be friends with. And I think in that scene where you, that you talked about where she's kind of getting to know these older kids, I think it's so fascinating to watch. I think Elsie Fisher, who plays Kayla, does such a beautiful job with some of those scenes where you're just watching her eyes and how much she wants to have this life. But I look at a kid like that, and I think this is why I didn't have that much cringe response. It's like, honestly, a kid like that will be okay.
Totally.
Like, she will find that as she gets older... I never didn't have confidence watching this movie. Oh, this girl is going to find her friends and is going to find her people. And she's lovely and her dad loves her and she has support at home. And, you know, it's not to say you can't go through terrible pain, but I looked at this girl and I was like, oh, it's just so, it is so hard when you're in that space where you don't know exactly who you are yet. To me, she was less awkward than just really genuine. And I think we're so accustomed to these precocious adolescents that a kind of a regular kid that age, played by a kid that age, suddenly looks impossibly young and sort of unpracticed.
Well, that is one of the things that Bo Burnham says he was aiming to do with this film, is to not, you know, to not create one of these reminiscences about adolescence that where everyone, I think that the words he used were like, everyone's a poet laureate, mm-hmm. where like people are speaking in sparkling dialogue. And instead you get a lot of, you know, like to be confident, you need to feel confident. and so that there's an effort to like kind of really capture that the kind of linguistic realism of that.
Yeah.
And we're not everybody is just like super snappy and clever.
Well, and when she makes those YouTube videos, one way to look at it is, you know, as Margaret was describing, she's saying, I want to talk about being confident and being yourself. On the one hand, you can say she's not really saying anything because she's not talking about the deeper feelings that she has. But you do see what she means to be committed to. And you also see how much she sees her role in those videos. You know, it's so easy to draw kids who are involved in YouTube as narcissists and all of that stuff. And what you see in those videos is that what she really wants to do is help. She really wants to, that the irony is she's hurting a lot because she feels alone. But what she goes to is, maybe I can help other people feel better. Maybe I can help other people be themselves and feel confident. And she has that little sign off where she says, Gucci.
Gucci.
And it doesn't really mean
so
anything.
Painful but every it's time just, she said it.
But it's just meant to be.
Not that way.
It's just meant to be a cute little kind of sign off to your.
Right. Your people. Know,
it's
your,
just your people.
Yeah, your
and
peers.
I find her so endearing. That I just felt like it's a terrible time, but with a couple of exceptions that we can talk about, I less felt like she was imperiled and more just like she's just in this very difficult moment.
It's a half-hearted attempt at some sort of like branding gesture too, like
right.
Gucci. and also though, but part of what struck me about these videos is that when you said Linda that like she's not necessarily really saying anything, but part of what she's also saying is repeating things that she's heard that you're supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start seeing, you know, someone trying to feel their way through these morsels of advice that are supposed to work, mm-hmm. but that mm-hmm. haven't been working, but perhaps in its sheer repetition and, you know, dissemination, all these other people will have its effect eventually.
Yeah. I almost saw those videos too as being like trickle down Oprah, you know, where like she has heard all of that sort of self
trickle down goop, perhaps.
Yeah, totally. Like she's heard all this self worth talk and she sort of thinks, oh, this is what young women talk about. And this is like a thing to do that sort of also fits in a cool Instagram, like maybe, or, you know, YouTube, like maybe my account will get really popular. You know, it's interesting what you're talking about, Linda, where you were like, I wasn't worried about this girl. To me, that felt like a little bit of a flaw of the film, in a sense that, like, I don't know if I ever bought that this girl had zero friends. I mean, you never see her have a single friend in the movie. I mean, until the boy that she meets in the pool, Kennedy's cousin, kind of befriends her. But I just, when I look back on eighth grade, I can think of girls 1,000 times more awkward than her who had friends. And I just feel like it didn't quite click to me. It wasn't quite believable to me that this girl would have zero friends at all.
But let's think about this other dimension that it probably would have been alien to our eighth grade selves, and that is the film is certainly a meditation on kind of social media and you know, living a mediated life, because we're talking about you know, how Kayla, mm-hmm. Elsie is the actress, the character Kayla is unseen. She is at once unseen, but also living in a world where everybody sees everything at the same time. Mm-hmm. So there's that kind of, you know, split aspect of existence. Yeah. And, you know, I just remember, like, when I was feeling alone, I'd have a chance to go to my room and be by myself and, like, imagine things. And I didn't have any these outlets to, you know, maybe speak to these potential audiences or anything else as a kind of solve for that feeling of loneliness. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know how, you know, you react particularly to the kind of social media dimensions of this notion that you're always going to be seen, even if you are, you know, emotionally unseen by others around you in meat space.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, if you're making YouTube videos but nobody's really watching them, are you really... is anybody really seeing you? And it's the same thing with, obviously, she spends a lot of time on Instagram and she spends a lot of time reading Facebook. But I'm not sure how much anybody else is paying attention to what she's trying to do and create and the image that she's trying to put out there of herself. And in terms of her having friends, I do think there are kids who don't have friends. At least there are kids who don't have friends for a week. And I think One detail that made that a little easier for me to understand was that it covers really a week in her life. And so I think you can perhaps believe that she has had friends, and, you know, people kind of come and go. And especially at that age, there's a lot of drama. And I don't think they're necessarily getting heavily into the backstory of whether she's ever had friends or whether she ever will have friends. But I definitely think you're seeing an isolated week in her life. And I thought it was dramatically a strength of the film that so much of it rests on this one actress and a lot of unspoken feeling, because a lot of times in a film like this, even if it's not a kid, even if it's an adult, you will have the one person, the parent, the friend, to whom they have scenes where they unburden themselves and they get a chance to kind of explain what their feelings are and lay out on the table, in case you're not up to speed, what they're feeling. And she really doesn't do that. She has conversations with her dad, but he has to, in the way that I think parents of kids this age sometimes do, he has to really pull things out of her and not pull too hard and be effusive about how much she loves her, but understand that she's going to throw it back in his face sometimes.
She'll be repulsed by it,
but he knows he has to do it. And I loved a lot of that, because she doesn't have that outlet. And I think a lot of kids that age, they don't necessarily have that outlet. They spend a lot of time not talking about how they feel. And I found it incredibly touching in that way.
And in the not talking about how you feel, though, I mean, is that, I mean, I don't want to pathologize social media, but is that just because we're just so used to representing, you know, like there's a whole scene where she's taking a bunch of selfies for Instagram, essentially, where she's making all the requisite poses or trying out different face filters and that kind of thing. Is it because you can't put anything out there that isn't affirmative in some way?
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking after I saw this film about the fact that when I was in eighth grade, certainly there was no social media. I am an old lady. But I thought about my diary, and I thought about the fact that nobody read my diary except me. And yet, were there elements of my diary that were essentially performative, that were essentially me describing my life as I wanted to think of it as being? I think there absolutely were. And there absolutely were moments when I was very dramatic about things in a way that emulated what I thought, how older people thought about their feelings and their important problems. So I think it's just, I think kids do tend to try on ways of describing themselves and describing their lives. I don't know that social media is the only way that that happens.
Yeah, I mean, the social media aspect in this movie was very scary, I think, for older people like us to see who didn't have social media when we were in junior high, because it just made me think about all the insecurities you have at that age and how they would have just been magnified by anything on social media. And, you know, my heart went out to her, but I feel like the movie... And let me just say, I really loved the movie and found it highly entertaining, but I still had issues with it. I feel like it fell in love with two things. Like, the idea of her being the super awkward, quiet girl and that being sort of, like, the only things I really walked away from the movie knowing about her. Like, I didn't know what music she liked. I didn't know her favorite color. I didn't know, like... just these other things that I think no matter how engrossed you are in social media, there's just like moments where you're not on social media. And you know, even with the dinner with the dad where he says, you know this is Friday night and I said you can be on the phone. I wanted to know what the other dinner nights were like. You know, if she's not allowed to be on the phone during the other dinner nights, what are they talking about? Like, what's happening? What is she saying? So I think the awkwardness kind of like became almost a crutch in a certain kind of way. Like that was like the characteristic that he sort of hammered again and again. And then the YouTube videos I found after a while like kind of redundant. Like I got it. I understood that she was sort of trying on this personality. And there are times where I feel like he put in the YouTube video dialogue where I just desperately wanted to be with her and her father in a scene. Namely, the scene after she comes home from the really upsetting encounter with the boy in the car. I wanted to just like be in it with them. Like I was oddly sort of dry-eyed through the movie in moments where I felt like I should have been more like emotionally invested and pulled in.
Mm-hmm. And that may also have to do with the fact that like you were saying, we don't know what does give her pleasure or like what world she escapes to. You hear her listening to music a few times.
Yeah.
And we don't really get a lot of pop cultural references until she's finally hanging out with Gabe,
yeah.
the kind of awkward dude who she meets at the pool party. And they make some reference to Szechuan sauce and Bob's Burgers and that kind of thing. But there's not a lot. It's, you know, where I think of a lot of, I suppose, adolescent films will often revel in that relationship to the music someone's listening to, the pop culture they're consuming, the things they're getting into at that time. We're going to get into more about this, and I'm going to ask each of you about, like, you know, your own eighth grade taste cultures. But there are really kind of two key pivotal scenes in the film that everybody's been talking about and that I'd like to get into in our conversation. And the first being the pool party scene. And I mean, it is, you know, so much about being an adolescent is like not really being fully aware of your body yet or being too hyper aware of your body and like not, I suppose, not inhabiting your body with any sense of like control or comfort. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of get your takes on that, because I think that that is like I meant to be the kind of showstopper, like emotionally, like kind of riveting and anxious, anxiety-inducing scene, right? So any thoughts on the pool party in particular and the way, you know, and even the way it's shot, I think, is a little bit like, it has elements of a horror film in it, the kind of perspective shots moving through, right?
Yeah. Most definitely.
So, and things that you may want to say about that particular moment,
Yeah, I mean, that pool party scene, it brought me back to how hard it can be to just be in very little clothes at that age in front of your peers. I mean, I think it's not to say that now I love going out into the world in a swimsuit. Like, I think, like most women, I have my issues and worries and insecurities. But I think, right, you know, at this time in my life, I'm just like, well, here it goes, you know, no changing now. But I think when you're in eighth grade, you're just like, you're changing. Your body is literally this wild card that is shifting underneath you. And the shots that they show of her having a panic attack in the bathroom, I just thought that was really touching and very real. And I think it did just, you know, even her posture going out towards the pool where she's sort of hugging herself and, you know, you see kind of the baby fat sort of rolling out a little bit on the swimsuit. I mean, I thought those details were just phenomenal. And, you know, it, like Linda was saying, you know, the kind of the idea of her being unseen really gets played out in the movie there, because it's not like the minute she steps out, everyone's like, ugh. Like, they just don't even take her in. You know, she gets in the pool and that guy, I think his name is Gabe, like swims over to her right away because he sees sort of the twin in the situation. You know, here's another person who doesn't really belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the relationship between them is an interesting one that I think fortunately is not, it's not overplayed too much. But I think in that first scene in the pool, you get that sense that exactly as Margaret said, you know, he is inclined when he sees another outsider to gravitate to her because he thinks here's somebody that maybe would welcome me. She, on the other hand, when she sees another outsider, she's thinking, don't you come over here because then we're two nerds together. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she means to be that way. But I think her reaction is, well, if you come over here, now we're uncool dork friends. And I think that may explain why she doesn't have friends, is that I think she's still leaning toward, I want to fit in and I want to I want to be normal and have everybody like me. And so when she sees her opportunity at the beginning at the pool to kind of, well, here's somebody who likes you and wants to hang out with you and kind of you dig this, you know, we're going to play a breath holding game or whatever. You're having fun with the guy, but she's so consumed by wanting everybody to like her and wanting to fit in that she can't kind of embrace that slightly offbeat friendship that he's offering to her. And I think later when you see them talking and they're talking about, yeah, I don't remember, it's Bob's Burgers or Rick and Morty and stuff like that. And you see them kind of talking, you see, oh, no, they like the same things. This is probably a good friend for her. And if she can accept it, like, yeah, my friends might be dorks. And then I'll have friends. And that's the way a lot of people's lives are.
The other scene that's really the kind of been a big talking point, and actually, Linda, you tweeted about this particular scene, and it is a truth or dare scene in the back of a car. She's getting a ride home from an older male high school student. And, you know, you get that uncomfortable feeling that something is about to happen, and it becomes like a scene of truth or dare. Linda's tweet about it suggested, I'm just going to read it, if you don't mind me quoting
sure,
the tweet
not at all,
back
not
to
at all.
You.
Not at all.
And, you know, there have been characterizations of this scene as a Me Too moment, potentially. There's an article in The Cut about that. And Linda's response was, quote, I admit that I have weird feelings about calling everything like this a Me Too scene now. It seems too broad for everything it's asked to include, that whole category.
Yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about...
I feel like I don't want anybody to fall into the trap of thinking that this type of experience is a new thing or a trend or a thing that's caused by social media or a thing that women have only started talking about recently. There actually have been lots and lots of people, including lots and lots of women, talking about things like this for many, many years. And I am unnerved by trying to find one label that covers, you know, pressuring an eighth grader when you're a male high school student and you're mostly pressuring her sort of emotionally and socially. Mm-hmm. For that to be in the same... You know, you're bringing in a very broad range of things when that's the same thing as like workplace bullying. I think it's very valuable, right? That Me Too conversation has been incredibly valuable. But I feel like I don't want it to become a thing where everything's just, oh, this is its Me Too thing. This is the Me Too era. This is the Me Too era is always. Mm-hmm. This is something that has always happened, and I think that's one of the things that conversation has brought out. I think the scene in this film is very carefully done to mm-hmm. to bring out a lovely thing about her, which is that she is capable in the end of drawing boundaries for herself, which turns out to be a really important skill for her. Absolutely. Even though she's incredibly uncomfortable doing it and she hates doing it and she immediately starts apologizing.
Yes.
She still does it. And that winds up being a really important thing for her to do. And I think that it's still incredibly painful and she still needs a lot of support. But you know, her drawing those boundaries is a step for her.
You know, I guess I'm not too concerned about it being labeled or not Me Too. The only way I think it might be useful to talk about it in a Me Too context is just because that movement has called us to think about all these sort of gray areas of like what it means to be sexually pressured and also the sort of power dynamics that get played out in these types of situations. And I feel like it wasn't a workplace situation and you know, she's not an adult, and in certain ways it certainly wasn't as dire as many, many of the things that have happened in the Me Too movement. But I do think, like, for her sort of time and feeling, it was very obviously, like, emotionally traumatic, right?
Oh, yeah. It's not a matter of this isn't important enough to be linked in with these other things. It's more – it's almost the opposite. It's almost all these things are so important. And there is certainly a thread of misogyny and power abuse that connects all of these things to each other. I don't dispute that in the slightest. I just worry about whether that is still useful when you're talking about solutions and when you're talking about what people need. I just question whether it's – I want to make sure that all the terminology we're using remains useful. That's all.
Well, I think maybe you're talking, too, about people just sort of shorthanding it at this point, just being like, oh, that's a Me Too moment.
Right. Yes.
And not thinking about sort of like the deeper, very gray, very nuanced textures of
and
that moment.
It's everyday power and sex that happens from the moment you are an adolescent or even before, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we all experience in like these scenes where someone in some position of social power or, you know, actual, you know, power comes in and tries to manipulate you into a situation that you don't want to be a part of. But it shows how like this is just so deeply and fully ingrained in like every girl, every woman's experience. It's not an unusual or an exceptional event, in other words.
Not
it's
at all.
Just kind of like at the center of.
When I watched it, I almost felt like, oh, yeah, this is sort of like a rite mm-hmm. of passage. Like, this happened to me at least 3 or 4 times. Exactly mm-hmm. this kind of moment of being mm-hmm. asked to do something sexually that I then kind of curled up in a ball and said, I don't want to. Like, I just barely stood mm-hmm. up for myself, and then I apologized for standing up mm-hmm. for myself. Like, that whole dichotomy was so familiar to me and painful to watch. But, yeah, I was proud of her when she did have the temerity to even say, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't want to do it. But yeah, I mean, I do think it was interesting to me, too, just thinking about him and speculating on who he was in the moment. It's like that behavior that he put upon her is something he has learned about. That has been something he's told is okay to do.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I could see this guy, even in like 5 years, like, you know, going to college and getting a little more woke and all of a sudden understanding that that was a terrible thing to do to a girl and shifting. I mean, I think it also shows like a certain kind of
or getting worse.
Well, that's
true.
What I was thinking.
Well, you know, either way, but I mean,
guy.
I can think of guys that I know who are nice guys now who did things like that and will admit mm-hmm. to have done mm-hmm. doing things like that when mm-hmm. they were younger and kind of didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. And I think there's just something to be, I think that was actually a strong moment to point out that like there, like boys and girls are flailing in ways that can really damage each other in that time of life, you know, that it's, and I'm not wiping his slate clean. Like, he is utterly responsible for his, obnoxious actions in that section, but it just made me think about, like, who would this person be down the road?
And the other part of it that I thought was so moving was the fact that that came out of her finding a group of kids that she felt, at least temporarily, sort of accepted her. And she felt something that I think will be really true, which is that she will enjoy high school seniors more than she enjoys eighth graders.
Oh, hell yeah.
I think it is her personality. Some kids are just like that. Sometimes they have to just gut it out. They are not comfortable as 14-year-olds, but they will do fine when they are 18.
Yeah.
And they will have plenty of friends and settle in, and it's horrible at the time. And so it's so sad that she finds that refuge. And that's what I find so affecting about her having that experience with that boy, is that it comes out of this refuge where she feels like, now I'm accepted and now I feel welcome and now I feel cared about by that girl who you keep expecting to reject her, who doesn't.
Yes.
You keep expecting that girl to be like, I don't really want to hang out with you.
Right.
You're 14.
Like, why are you calling me?
Why are you calling me? And she doesn't. And it's such a great story choice, I think, that girl really likes her. Like, she sees her as a younger kid, but she likes her. She enjoys her. Fun. Come hang out with us, you know.
Did you ever hang out with either of you, hang out with older kids when you were in eighth grade? Did you?
Oh, absolutely. That was like my goal in life at that age.
So, tell me a little bit about your eighth grade self, Margaret Wapplin. What years were you in the eighth grade? Or what year were you in the eighth grade?
I was in eighth grade, 89 to 90. And I had a boyfriend who was 16. And I thought that meant he was a man.
Wow.
Like, absolutely a grown-ass adult. And I basically, he bought me a ring from Service Merchandise. Do you guys remember Service Merchandise?
I do.
Yeah. I mean, it was maybe $100 or something huge.
Wow.
Yeah. He, like, spent a couple of months of the record store salary. And I really was just like, I looking back on it, it's like embarrassing to remind myself that I was just like totally enraptured by him and like really just cared about dudes at that age. Dudes and like putting on my eyeliner, music. I mean, I definitely was, you know, I was still like into writing, and I read Rolling Stone like it was the Bible, and I, you know, hung out with friends, and I was very like vivacious and alive in certain ways, but then like mercurial, where I could just turn on a dime and like call my mother a bitch, you know, like that was
wow. So you were not quite like Kayla then.
No.
At all. I mean, you're more like the girls in 13.
I really was. I mean, I wasn't that hardcore, but I 13. Mean, I was much more of a bad girl than I think Kayla was. Yeah. Like Kayla struck me as very much a late bloomer, which was interesting to see, actually, and made me feel very tender towards her. I think when I was in eighth grade, I like already was like 34 in my mind.
Mm. I think I was the sort of extroverted version of Kayla. I think where I actually did live my kind of like theatrical signed playbill self, like, you know, I inhabited that self pretty openly. And I was, you know, I was definitely a nerd, but I was like a very socially active, vivacious nerd who was in the band and who liked drama and who loved Phantom of the Opera and Les Mis. I did my, you know, eighth grade project on Les Miserables, the novel.
Oh, my God. Sure. You're a precious little thing.
And I wrote like a piece for saxophone and clarinet, duet.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I did those like kind those things. And I think that I was sort of unabashedly nerdy. And I also really, my kind of turn to feeling deep or being deep was getting really into the 60s and what an important time it was. Because I finished eighth grade in 1987. So my eighth grade year spanned 86 to 87. And it was, you know, the Monkees 20th reunion. And so I think I was really into history. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
I think there was something about that period of time where like we were all obsessed with the 60s. Mm-hmm. And that was like the decade we all wanted to go back to.
Yeah.
And if anything, like being a junior high student in 90 and then going into high school, the 90s were like set up to directly compete with the 60s.
Yeah.
It was like, are we going to be the next cool generation or what? You know, the slackers, Generation X.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that, I don't know. I mean, I also appreciated that I spent a lot of time actually not seeing friends physically as often, but I did spend a lot of time on the phone.
Oh, yeah,
with
the phone.
So
hours
on the phone, hours on the phone, and with the long cord that you could just pull into another room and shut the door and the cord would be hanging out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
How about you, Linda? When did you go to middle school?
Well, I'm the oldest. Mm-hmm. I was in eighth grade in 84, 85.
Okay. So we're like kind of 2 years apart, all of
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
We're
a family.
Yeah.
And I was very uncool by kind of conventional standards. I was mm-hmm. a fat kid. My teachers, my parents were teachers at my school. I had a lot of like strikes against me in conventional popularity terms. Mm-hmm. My eighth grade year was when I participated in a math contest.
Oh, cool!
One of the coolest things you can Mathlete. Do. I think, agree.
Mathlete.
And I wound up going to. I lived in the Philadelphia area, but I wound up going to a national math competition because I went to school in Delaware, so I got to compete in Delaware to be on the Delaware state team. That's a small state.
Yeah.
Easier to get on it
yeah.
than a lot of places. I would not have gotten on like the California team, but I could get on the Delaware team. So went to a math competition in D.C., came back. To Delaware, and they wanted to honor us at the Delaware Society of Professional Engineers banquet because the Delaware Society of Professional Engineers had paid for our trip to go to this math competition in D.C. So I go to the banquet, and they're serving the dinner, and I am sawing at this very, like, stubborn piece of chicken because, of course, it's dry chicken because it's a banquet.
Banquet,
and I'm dressed up, so I'm in, like, a nice dress.
84-85, I'm thinking some like hot pink or turquoise was
no
involved.
No, this was a grown-up event, so it was like a silver dress that I think maybe I had
dressy.
Worn to someone's bat mitzvah maybe.
Yeah,
so it had like what I remember it was like a gray silver dress that had like dark silver stripes. I was in the middle of sawing this chicken and I flipped the entire plate into my lap, face down, with all of the food in my lap and my plate on top. And then the plate slowly slid off of the food and clanged onto the floor.
Oh,
so now
man.
I'm sitting there at this big banquet with all these people, and I have no food in front of me, and there's no plate, and I have a lap full of food on the napkin. Now, this all turned out okay. It was fine. I wrapped it up. I put it on the table. I managed to kind of fake my way through the rest of the meal.
You stayed hungry.
It was fine. But later, I wrote an essay about it. And I don't think it was then. I think I wrote it a couple years later. But that was the event. That was completely the inciting incident for me to start writing like things that were supposed to be funny or like kind of self-deprecating. Or that was the birth of that as a survival mechanism, was that incredibly kind of humiliating moment that like wasn't terribly personal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like my pants fell down or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was just food in my lap. So I wrote a funny essay about it, and that was a very, very formative moment. So it was like I'm saying about Kayla, it's like that moment when you start to find what are going to be your ways out. Mm-hmm. Like, what are going to be your ways of surviving? And mine was always going to be writing.
Yeah. So the diary performativity then became the thing that
found its
expression in
but
the world
I started
a couple years later.
By middle of high school, I started to realize, oh, well, hell, I've had a million experiences where I felt like an asshole. I can write about that all day long. Like,
right.
All right, let's fire up the brand new Macintosh SE we have, and I'm going to write a bunch of stories about
That's
myself.
Wonderful. Yeah. One piece of popular culture that you would say was the thing that defined your eighth grade experience.
I would be lying if I didn't say it was General Hospital. It was General Hospital. I was a soap person. I watched Days of Our Lives and General Hospital at that time. And
did
that
you
was
VHS
like my big
them? Because
thing.
Weren't you in school?
Yeah. Okay. Yep, VCR.
What about you, Margaret?
Well, I mean, I would say music. I was really anchored into music at that point. And I had a hard time picking the jam because I really wanted to go back to 1989. It's too hard to pick just one, but I would have to say, like, I listened just preparing for this show to U2's Rattle and Hum, which was just, I loved that record so much. And it still is really exciting and vibrant and to listen to. And it reminds me of the fact that U2 just used to seem like this super authentic, salt of the earth kind of band before they took that turn in the 90s where like Bono started to embrace his stardom and wore those giant glasses and all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
it's It's a great album. I mean, I still love it. And I think just in general, I a lot of the sort of feelings of like rebellion and wanting to be like a badass or something I like put into music.
There's a lot of maturity, too. Like, I think that, you know, in U2 in particular, like,
well,
you
the
felt
political
like
aspects.
Very political and sophisticated and adult listening to U2 at
I
that
did.
Age.
Yeah. And I was kind of like starting to get politically minded in certain ways that that album like opened me up.
And this
to.
Was only a few. This was only like a couple years after like Live Aid and stuff like that. Yeah. Which was a very like activist, believe mm-hmm. it or not, a very activist time in kind of pop music and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So.
Well, you Rocketeers know that one of the most important films to me ever was one of the biggest films that year, and that's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which I can't possibly talk about again on this show, but let's just say, you know, I'm not going to elaborate, but, you know, I was a real big consumer of pop culture at the time, and I already mentioned the whole Les Mis fascination, and that, you know, kind of that theatricality has carried me throughout the rest of my life and everything I've done. So, but Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home is always going to be in our text. And, you know, someday we're going to need to know how to save the planet and we're going to need to be able to bring back humpback whales from 1986. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's an angle on the film. That's what happens.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Spoiler alert.
All right.
Anyway.
If you haven't seen it yet, it's been spoiled for you now.
Yeah. So, anyway, you've been listening to Pop Rocket and we'll be right back with our jams right after this.
You probably know that Max Fun podcasters are funny in the talking way, but did you know they also are funny in the writing way? We are very excited to announce that John Hodgman and Paula Poundstone wrote books that have been named as semi-finalists for the 2018 Thurber Prize for American Humor. John Hodgman, celebrated fake internet court presider, is the host of Judge John Hodgman and was recognized for his book Vacation Land. Paula Poundstone's book is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, and you can hear her expound on happiness and many other topics on her new podcast, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. The Thurber Prize is one of the highest awards for humor writing in the United States, and we are proud to have both these authors on Maximum Fun every week. Paula Poundstone and John Hodgman, congratulations.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Margaret Wappler.
And Linda Holmes.
So before we get to our jams, I have to remind everyone, summer days are waning and the summer book club is upon us. Margaret, please. Tell us, how many days do we have left to cram this novel into our summer schedule?
Okay, the time is nigh. You have to get Crazy Rich Asians and read it now because we are going to discuss it for the show on August 17th. And you still have enough time at this point to get Crazy Rich Asians and then dive into the rest of the trilogy and see what you think.
Another task you are assigned, dear Rocketeers, is that we need more candidates for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval, the new segment and new honorific that we are going to bestow upon some of your favorite objects and people of popular culture. And I'm the head of the nominating committee for those of us here in the studio. But Rachel Rosing, the group moderator, has created a thread on the Facebook page where you can make some of your recommendations. A couple of you have already made them. Jack Hardy, for example, really wants Cher. And we've got like a big nomination statement from Amelia Stobaugh, who would like to nominate Terry Crews for the Seal of Approval because he is, quote, hilarious, smart, and a real proponent of changing the culture of toxic masculinity.
She made a good argument.
Very good argument. So get on the thread, folks. We'll inform you about other steps that we're going to be taking with the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval on our Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast. So every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the question, and you know what it is. What is that question, Margaret?
I believe it's, what is your jam?
What is your jam? Linda Holmes is our special guest this week. What is your jam?
Well, my jam this week is an opportunity to plug a great project that I was not involved with at NPR, which is at NPR Music. You might remember a year ago, they did a project called Turning the Tables, which named the 150 best albums by women since 1964. This year, they have done another installment that is the 200 best songs of the 21st century by women and non-binary artists. And they range from pop to rock, things that you know very, very well, things that you know much less well. They are influenced by things all around the world. I'm so proud of them. And my jam is one of the entries on this list of 200 songs, which is the indelible Kelly Clarkson, Since You've Been Gone.
And all you'd ever hear me say is how I picture me with you. That's all you.
I will take any opportunity to play that song, and you can find more like it at NPR Music.
I'm so jealous of the eighth graders who had that be there, so, like eighth grade anthem.
Such a
so
fucking
good.
Jam.
All the eighth grade girls who had that as their anthem. Mm-hmm. Way to go.
That had to be somebody's little junior prom theme, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Yeah. Margaret, what is your jam this week?
Wine.
Sip, 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 gulp, gulp, gulp. I picked a jam that pretty much set my hair on fire when I first heard it. I think in 1989, we were really excited about the 90s. It was coming. We were on the cusp of it. I graduated technically in 1990 from eighth grade. And this album from Nine Inch Nails, Pretty Hate Machine, basically made the turn for me to the 90s, where there was obviously like synth music out there, but this had this very like gritty industrial hard edge that I found super intoxicating and exciting because it was like bad. I know you're probably sensing a theme here. Like I was
bad girl Margaret Wapner.
I mean, I just wanted to rebel at that age so much. And this is one of the songs on the album called Down In It.
Kind of like a cloud, I was up way up in the sky and I was feeling some feelings you wouldn't believe. Sometimes I don't believe in myself and I decided I was never coming down. Just then a tiny
anyway, that scared me in all the best ways.
Nice.
As a wee child.
There's something kind of inexcess-ish about it, actually.
Yeah, sure, totally. Sure. And when you hear it now, it's like, this is a synth pop album. Totally. Yeah. Like
it sounds very of the time.
Yeah. But at the same time, back then, it didn't sound as light and frothy, maybe, as the term synth pop connotes usually. Yeah.
Well, so my jam this week is also from my eighth grade year, 1987, which was an annus mirabilis of summer jams. Unlike this year, which, you know, I really wanted to come in with a candidate for the 2018 summer jam, but had much more fun digging into the archive and thinking about some of the great songs that were considered songs of the summer in 87, including Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody, George Michael's I Want Your Sex, U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, Hearts Alone, I think, like, topped the charts for the longest period of time that summer. But this particular song, another song of the summer of 1987, still bears the traces of eighth grade innocence. And I think it strikes the contrast between eighth grade Margaret Wapner and eighth grade Karen Tongson. And it is Debbie Gibson's Only in My Dreams. It's got some of that like 80s, like mid to late 80s freestyle like beat action happening in it, but it's like not dirty.
I'll tell you, that Debbie Gibson and Tiffany stuff from around that time, there is some good stuff in there and everybody should appreciate
that
it.
That is pure pop.
Yes.
And, you know, like I said, like there are many things about it that like resembled or stole from the like Lisa and the Cult Jam playbook.
Yes, totally.
But it sent it to the mall. They sent it to the mall and like, you know.
Yeah, that's like the Claire's version.
Put rainbow sprinkles on it. Yeah.
I love, by the way, in eighth grade that she walked by Claire's at one point.
Yes.
I was like, yes.
the movie eighth grade, yes.
No junior high movie can be complete in my mind without a little Claire.
God bless Claire's for existing for so long.
For
and
real.
Being there.
And giving us all scrunchies and ear piercings when we needed it desperately.
Absolutely. All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Karen Tongson, with Margaret Wappler and Linda Holmes. Linda, where can people find you online?
People can find me on the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, or they can find me at npr.org, where my writing is also in our Pop Culture Happy Hour section.
Thanks for coming to join us this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Always
this is
such
really
a pleasure
fun.
To have you
yes.
here.
Great
thank
to have
you.
You. Here. Thank you. Thank you.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us, or else Margaret Wappler may need to get a completely new blood transfusion.
I may have to go to this Goop Wellness Conference.
Yeah,
and
she may need to get some jade eggs.
Yeah, exactly. All the dry brushes.
So this week, we'd like to thank Zach Jacoby. Quote, I'm so excited I got Guy's book. Yay! How fast do I have to read it before you talk about it? Flawed female character also left us a lovely review. She said, leaving review after listening to this podcast for over a year because I don't want to be complicit in the downfall of Margaret's good health. I discovered this show way back from listening to Guy on Gilmore Guys, and it quickly became my fave pod. NHB8, I think that's how you say it, or NHB8, says that we are insightful and delightful. The best thing to listen to while I'm walking about town. What town are you walking around listening to me say hi, Rocketeers, or Magwaps talk about jade eggs?
For real.
Let us know. Get in touch with us on our Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and be part of the discussion. And I already plugged our Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast, where you will be learning more soon about the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Shana Deloria, and our senior producer is Laura Swisher, Swish Bish.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.